And welcome to another episode. Let's start it off with some Ivy.
Washington's decision to ban the sale and distribution of English ivy, Hetera helix, and Atlantic ivy, Hetera hibernica, marks a significant step in environmental stewardship. These plants, though beloved for their lush appearance and use in landscaping, are not native to North America. They hail from Europe, particularly regions like England, Ireland, and parts of Western Europe, and were introduced to the U.S. as ornamental ground cover and climbing vines. Their arrival was innocent enough, but their impact has been anything but. Once planted, ivy spreads aggressively. It climbs trees, depriving them of sunlight, weakening their structure, and eventually killing them. It blankets forest floors, choking out native understory plants and reducing biodiversity. In urban areas, it can damage infrastructure, scale buildings, and create fire hazards. Washington joins Oregon, which banned English ivy in 2010, in recognizing that the ecological cost far outweighs the aesthetic benefit. Removing ivy has clear upsides. It allows native plants to recover, restores forest health, and reduces the risk of tree collapse during storms, a real concern in the Pacific Northwest. It also saves municipalities millions in maintenance and restoration costs. But removal is labor-intensive. Ivy roots cling tightly, and eradication often requires repeated efforts over years. Still, the long-term gain is worth the sweat. Allowing ivy to remain unchecked, on the other hand, is a recipe for ecological degradation. It's a slow-motion invasion that transforms vibrant ecosystems into monocultures. And because ivy is still sold in many nurseries, its spread continues. Washington's ban, effective August 9th, 2025, aims to cut off that supply chain. As for kudzu, yes, there's a connection, though they're not botanically related. Kudzu is a vine native to Asia, infamous for its rapid spread across the southeastern U.S. Both kudzu and ivy are invasive, fast-growing, and ecologically destructive. They represent a broader issue. The unintended consequences of introducing non-native species without understanding their long-term impact. One thing people should know is that ivy's invasiveness isn't just a forest problem. It's a climate problem. Dense ivy growth can alter soil chemistry, reduce carbon sequestration by killing trees, and disrupt water cycles. It's also a public safety issue. Trees weakened by ivy are more likely to fall during storms, posing risks to homes and infrastructure. Washington's move is a model for other states. It shows that environmental policy can be driven by grassroots activism. Citizens and nonprofits petition for this change, and that governments can respond with meaningful action. It's a reminder that what we plant matters, and that beauty without balance can come at a steep ecological price.
Alrighty. Now to some developments that were once unethical, but hey, it's the 2020s. Who knows? Alrighty.
The creation of lab-grown mini amniotic sacs called post-gastrulation amnioids, PGAs, is a quiet revolution in developmental biology. These structures, grown from human embryonic stem cells, mimic the amniotic sac that forms in the first month of pregnancy. That sac is not just a passive balloon of fluid. It's a dynamic, protective environment that cushions the embryo, regulates nutrients, and influences cell development. Until now, it's been nearly impossible to study the stage of human development due to ethical and technical constraints. This breakthrough changes that. The significance of these amniotic sacs lies in their complexity and longevity. Unlike previous models that lasted only a few days and failed to replicate the sac's two-layered structure, PGAs survive for up to 3 months and grow to the size of a real amniotic sac, about an inch across. They self-organize from stem cells exposed to two signaling molecules, BMP4 and CHIR, forming a fluid-filled structure with distinct layers that resemble the natural sac. That's not just impressive, it's unprecedented. The purpose of this research is twofold. First, it allows scientists to study early human development in a way that was previously inaccessible. Second, it opens the door to medical applications. Amniotic tissue has antimicrobial and anti-inflammatory properties and is already used in burn treatments and corneal repairs. But sourcing it from donors is inconsistent. PGAs could provide a standardized, renewable supply of these cells, potentially even customized from a patient's own stem cells. This is important because it gives us a new lens into congenital disorders. Some birth defects are linked to abnormalities in the amniotic sac size or composition. With PGAs, researchers can observe how these structures form and interact with surrounding cells. In fact, the study showed that PGAs can influence nearby stem cells to become other extraembryonic tissues, like those found in the placenta or yolk sac. That means the sac isn't just a container, it's a signaling hub. For society, the implications are vast. In medicine, PGAs could lead to better treatments for burns, eye injuries, and uterine damage. In education, they offer a new way to teach embryology, not just through diagrams, but through living models. And in ethics, they provide a way to study early development without using human embryos, sidestepping one of the most contentious issues in biology. Ultimately, these tiny sacs are a reminder that life's earliest stages are more intricate than we imagined. They show that stem cells, given the right cues, can build entire ecosystems of support around an embryo. And they offer hope that science can illuminate the hidden corners of human development without compromising our values.
Yikes! Well, some good news. Let's have some reckoning. I think we all deserve some reckoning.
The reckoning unfolding in Maryland over the abuses at Boys Village, once the House of Reformation for Colored Boys, is part of a broader national pattern. Across the United States, states are being forced to confront the legacy of institutional harm inflicted on Black, Indigenous, and other marginalized youth. Maryland's financial settlements and legal reforms, especially under the Child Victims Act, are not isolated gestures of remorse. They echo a growing wave of accountability. At least seven other states have initiated similar efforts. One, California. Through its Reparations Task Force, California has explored financial compensation and systemic reforms for descendants of enslaved people and victims of racial violence, including those harmed in juvenile detention systems. Two, Illinois, Chicago's reparations program for survivors of police torture under John Birch was one of the first in the nation to offer financial compensation, counseling, and education to victims, many of whom were Black youth. Three, North Carolina. The state acknowledged its role in the forced sterilization of thousands, including young Black girls in state custody, and created a compensation fund for survivors. Four, Florida. The state paid reparations to survivors of the 1923 Rosewood Massacre, a racially motivated attack that destroyed a Black town. The reparations included scholarships and direct payments to descendants. 5. Oklahoma. Tulsa has faced mounting pressure to compensate descendants of the 1921 race massacre. Though no formal reparations have been issued, lawsuits and legislative efforts are underway. 6. New York. The state has begun reviewing its juvenile justice history, including abuses at facilities like the Tryon School for Boys, and has expanded legal pathways for survivors to seek redress. 7. Massachusetts. The state has acknowledged abuses in its youth detention centers and has paid settlements to survivors of sexual abuse and neglect. These actions raise a difficult question. Are they driven by genuine remorse or strategic self-preservation? The timing of many of these settlements, often just before legal caps or deadlines, suggests a mix of both. Maryland, for instance, saw a surge of lawsuits before its damages cap was lowered, indicating that urgency may have been driven more by legal exposure than moral reckoning. Remorse, if genuine, would be accompanied by transparency, long-term reform, and survivor-centered healing. But when states quietly settle cases, cap damages, or resist public apologies, it feels more like damage control than contrition. The comparison to Russia's alleged admission that Jesus was Black is provocative. While the viral claims about Putin revealing this have been debunked, the metaphor still resonates. It speaks to how powerful institutions sometimes use symbolic gestures to rewrite narratives, hoping to absolve themselves without fully confronting the harm they've caused. In the end, financial settlements are only one step. True accountability requires listening to survivors, dismantling the systems that allowed abuse, and ensuring that history is not just acknowledged, but never repeated. If states are sincere, they'll go beyond the courtroom and into the classroom, the legislature, and the community. Otherwise, they're just trying to outrun a reckoning that's already at their doorstep.
See? I wouldn't have it completely crazy. Well, think about that in your quiet moments. And until next time, when we meet at the crossroads, peace.